Thank you very much, Kate. Yes, I am Glenn, if we haven't met before. Love to catch up afterwards if you'd like to. I'm just here this week doing the interviews, and I've loved getting to know all sorts of different people. We had Ed Watson talking about anxiety and depression on Tuesday, and we had Shubi Awoyemi, was that yesterday? Was that only yesterday? Yes, it was only yesterday, on different religions. And now tonight we have Jeremy Marshall here talking under the banner of City Success and Incurable Cancer. So there's a bit of a spoiler there. we're going to start with City Success and then talk about the diagnosis. But can you just introduce yourself to us, and why do we have that first line there, City Success?
Sure, yeah, I was wondering that myself. So my last job in the city was chief executive of a family-owned private bank called C. Hoare & Co., which was founded about 350 years ago, and still owned by the same family. I was fortunate enough to be the first ever non-family chief executive, and despite my best efforts, the bank is still going strong. And Hoare's is a private bank, which is a euphemism for dealing with very wealthy people. And before that, which I'm sure Maidenhead is rams full of them. If any of you are clients, you can come and give me a little kind of nod afterwards.
Secret handshake.
And before that, I was 20 years with Credit Suisse, also in private banking in Switzerland and the US.
So when you say the very rich, how wealthy are some of these clients?
Oh, some clients are extremely wealthy, multi-billionaires.
Wow.
I mean, if someone's only worth 50 or 100, that's not terribly interesting.
But chump change, as the Americans say.
Yeah, chump change, that's right. Yeah, okay. When you start getting to 500 million and up, then that's serious
that's
money.
That's some serious money.
But the funny thing is that whatever you have, it's never enough. So if you have someone who's worth 500 million, then they say, oh, I'm not really rich. It's Jeff Bezos or Steve Jobs or something. They're the rich people. I'm just sort of shuffling along.
Yes, because everyone knows someone a little bit wealthier, so they don't think of themselves as extraordinarily rich, even though, I mean, I guess everyone in this room, kind of globally speaking and historically speaking, we are so far up the 1%, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, everybody in the UK, by definition, is rich in terms of global rich.
Yes.
You think there are 2 billion people living on $1 a day.
Yes.
But no, when people have money, they want more. And most people in the city and entrepreneurs are driven. So enough is never enough. And they're always pursuing happiness, pursuing fulfillment. But whenever they get to a certain level, that's never enough. They always want more.
Mm-hmm. And do you, in your role with these clients, do you ever have to say no to a billionaire? Do you ever have to kind of direct and tell them they're wrong?
Oh, all the time. But okay. Whether they like that, Ken, is another question.
But I'm sure they don't like that.
No, what they complain about more than anything is fees.
Okay.
I can tell you they're very wealthy, some of them anyway, are quite fee conscious.
Really?
And will make comments that you're charging them too much and this is an outrage. And
yes.
So and I didn't get where I am by leaving lots of money lying around.
Right.
So yeah.
Right, a lot of Scrooges around.
Yeah, yeah. Not everybody. Some people are very generous and I admire that. The Hoare family, for example, are very philanthropic and give a lot of money away. And other people are very generous as well. But in general, yeah, that's a fun part of private banking is saying no to very wealthy, very powerful people who, strangely enough, don't always like it.
Yes, yes, yes. The toys get thrown at that stage. Okay. What does money mean for those who have lots of it?
That's a good question. I think it means three things. I think one, especially I'm thinking here of investment banking, it's a means of keeping the score. Mm-hmm. And that results in very strange and dysfunctional behavior. So you can go in, and banking is the only industry where your whole year is determined by a five-second conversation where someone tells you you're getting X. So someone, I've seen this happen all the time, someone gets a very large amount, they say someone gets £1 million, and they're dissatisfied because their neighbor who they sit next to got 1.3 million, and they think, well, I'm better than him or as good as him.
Right.
So the human heart is this dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's about power. Mm-hmm. If you've got money, it makes you very powerful. And by the way, that can lead to abuse. Look at cases that are in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, and I think this is in the long run the most important, I think people look for money because it brings security.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an entrepreneur and you're starting from nothing, You think if I could make 100 million, 500 million, then I'm safe. Even if my business fails, I'm fine.
Mm. Security against what?
Against the vicissitudes of life,
mm-hmm.
against other people,
mm-hmm.
against all the things that can go wrong in life. But yes. the irony, which of course we're going to come on to in a minute, is that the one thing it doesn't give you security
yes.
from is death.
Yes.
It also, money often can be very toxic and dysfunctional. Not always.
Mm-hmm.
Some rich people are very content. But in general, it can do very strange things to families. And there's an example in the paper. I don't know the people. I don't know anything about the story. But I couldn't help but be struck and feel sad in a way about this story about the Barclay brothers. Did you all see that? If you haven't, it's been all over the newspapers. The Barclay brothers, they're twin brothers. They live in Brecu in the Channel Islands. They own the Telegraph and the Ritz Hotel. And the children of one of the brothers are suing their cousins because they allege that they bugged the tables at the Ritz and were eavesdropping on their conversation.
Okay.
And the other side of this lawsuit don't deny that they did bug it, but they say they didn't do anything wrong with it.
Right.
So you think, what on earth has happened in this family that they've had this tremendously wealthy, I think they would be in the sort of 30 wealthiest families in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and yet they're what do the brothers think? Twins as well, that their own children are going after each other in such
yes.
a public way as well.
Yes.
It's one thing if you have differences, you know, all families have arguments, but to play it out on the front page of your own newspaper, that's
yes.
really strange.
Yes. So it's strange that this thing that we chase, all of us, is this thing that somehow is toxic to us and somehow twists us and...
Yeah, I think, Glenn, that's right. I would say that most people in the city are very driven. That's why they go into the city as opposed to being a shepherd in Cumbria and or in Maidenhead, I guess.
Shepherd in Maidenhead?
Any shepherds here are probably being flooded down the Thames as we speak, poor people.
True.
But no, people are looking for something. They're dissatisfied. There's a story about that in the Bible. There was a man who... Jesus told this story, who had a big barns. In those days, you made money not with the internet, but with farming. And this man's got plans for the future, and he thinks, I've done well, but I'm going to tear down my barns and build greater. He's got a 5-10 year plan, and he's very happy with himself. He's very secure, and he thinks, I'm a smart guy, all these other low-life peasants, but look at me. And God says to him, you fool, you stupid person. This night your soul will be demanded of you. And Jesus says, what does it benefit someone if they gain the whole world and lose their soul?
Hmm.
So people in the city are driven by money, and they worship money. I don't mean they literally have a shrine to a dollar sign, but it's what gives them worth. That's what you were asking, what does money mean? Well, it gives people worth, a sense of worth. And that's where the word worship comes from. So we're all designed, I would argue, to worship something and put significance into something. But ultimately, money is a delusion. It's an illusion. It will not give you satisfaction, and it may well make your family very unhappy. So yeah. The people in the city are pursuing happiness in having lots of money, and it's a mirage.
Yes, yes. and maybe it is very obvious what we worship. I mean, there is a cityscape of London, and it has always been the case that the objects of worship have been the largest buildings, whether it's the pyramids, whether it's ziggurats, whether it's mosques, whether it's cathedrals. Those have always dominated the skyline. And now what is it that dominates the skyline? You know, what are our objects of worship? It's very interesting. Have people seen Slido.com? Because I have put a question here on Slido.com, and the first person to upvote my question will get a prize. I don't know what the prize will be.
It won't be money.
I
was going to say, Glenn, this is a city evening, so it's got to be money.
Money. All right. Well, I'll give you a bonus. But do be thinking of questions that you can put to Jeremy, including financial consultancy. I'm sure you'll be happy to sort out our finances for us. But as we've been thinking, and as we're heading towards this second line, there are things that money can't buy you. They can't buy you happiness. And it can't protect you against that phone call from the doctor who says, I can't give you the results over the phone. You'll need to come into the office. Tell me about, I guess the first health scare you had was in 2012. Tell us about what happened then.
Yeah, so one day in the shower, I felt a tiny lump on my ribs. Being a typical man, I didn't do anything. And then my wife said, stop delaying, go to the GP. I went to the GP, said, it's nothing to worry about. It's just a fatty lump, but we'll get it checked out. And then maybe a number of you have been through that, where you get passed from specialist to specialist, and each person says, I don't know what that is, but we need to run more tests. And then eventually I ended up being told, we've referred you to the Marsden. Well, the Marsden only does one thing, cancer. It's the world's oldest folk cancer specialist hospital. So I went there, this was 2013 early, and they told me, we're really sorry, you've got cancer, rare type of cancer. It's sarcoma, which is cancer of the muscle tissue. And the good news is that we caught it fairly early. It's stage two in the sort of five stages, and we think we can deal with it. So I went through treatment for about 6 months, had various operations, radiotherapy, and then everything seemed to go back to normal. And for the next 2 years, I went every 3 months, and then eventually every 6 months.
Okay, and so you were thinking that, well, that was my little midlife scare, yeah. And then onwards and upwards.
Yeah.
But then that wasn't to be in 2015.
No, then much more seriously, in 2015, I was at a friend's house, and I went to adjust my collar, and I felt this massive lump on my collarbone just here. The first one was tiny, and this one was almost like a golf ball, really large. And within, a few seconds, my life changed forever, because I knew straight away what it was, and I felt sick to the stomach. Mm. And I said, I'm really sorry, I don't feel well, I need to go home. Told my wife, who was with me on the way home. Went back to the hospital, had checkups, and then a day that's seared in my memory, Friday the 13th, appropriately enough, of June 2015, I was waiting in the waiting room, and the nurse said, please come through, and we were walking just 20 feet maybe down to the doctor's office, and on the way she said, I'm really, really sorry. And that was a sort of 2-3 second warning. I went in, there were lots of people there, and they said, look, we're really sorry, we don't know how we missed it, but you've got tumours everywhere, and there's not really a great deal we can do, and we can't cure you. And I said, well, how long do you think I've got? And the doctor said, well, 18 months.
Wow.
And I burst into tears, and please don't think I'm some kind of amazing Christian or cancer expert. I'm nothing of the sort. I'm just an ordinary person who's struggling to live with cancer, which is a very hard disease, and the hardest thing of all is to have to go home from the hospital and tell my three adult children, who are all over the country, so we had to do a sort of death drive and drive around and tell them, although one of them thought we'd come to tell them that the dog had died. And actually, our dog, like me, is a bit of a kind of living miracle. He's still alive.
So it was a good news, bad news kind of. Which do you want?
Exactly, yeah. So I think Millie, who's our dog, is actually more beloved by the children than me.
So this is a massive torpedo into your world, isn't it? And had you had much experience of ill health up until
2012? No, none until 2012. I'd never been in a hospital in my life, really.
Right.
And since then, I haven't been out. If you read about an NHS crisis, I'm the person responsible. I've had 24 chemos, 12 operations, radiotherapy, various experimental things. I've had big problems with my eyes as well. I was blind for a while and lost the sight of both eyes. I got the sight back in this eye. A number of you know two of my three charming sisters who go to this church. They're not here, so I can tell a joke against them. So Sarah, who's the middle one, she said she would take me by the arm and walk me to my hospital appointment, but only if I had a badge saying it's my brother, not my husband. So that's sisters for you.
That's a very sisterly thing, yes.
Yeah. So it's been really hard, and it's been hard for my wife. It creates tremendous uncertainty. You can't plan anything. I go every 2 months for scans. So I go through chemo. Your hair falls out, which for a guy is not so bad. Then I stop chemo and it's regrown. And every time I went week before last, and they said, well, there's probably no growth. We'll see you again in 2 months. So we came home, and that was good. So I just live. I'm really happy to be alive. I realize also I'm quite fortunate. I've responded. I mean, chemo is a deeply unpleasant thing.
Hmm. But tell us about how unpleasant chemo is.
Sure you are.
Yeah.
Well, the ways of treating cancer, you either cut it, surgery, you burn it, radiotherapy, or you poison it, chemo.
Yes.
So chemo is poisoning you. it targets all fast-growing cells, which is why your hair falls out, your fingernails do strange things. And everybody reacts differently. But the thing, I've been fortunate, I've never been sick, which many people are. But you just feel exhausted. Mm. I'm like an old man of 85, 90. I can hardly walk 100 yards. We live on a slight hill. And, when I'm in the middle of chemo, sometimes I have to sit on a wall and just kind of gather my breath.
Mm. Mm.
So
how old are you?
56.
56, yeah. And do you ever sit and daydream what Jeremy Marshall might have been doing if you weren't ill?
No, I don't, Glenn. No, I'm just so happy to be alive. I'm incredibly happy to be alive.
Yeah.
And I love doing this. I love telling people about Jesus, and I feel incredibly privileged to be alive. Every day I wake up and I think I'm alive, and if I feel okay, I think I feel okay as well.
Wow,
it's amazing. Yeah, it makes you really happy.
Yes.
and content. But it's also the biggest emotion, I would say, is fear.
Okay,
so that's the strongest thing I feel. I'm afraid of dying because I've had my father and other people, my mother-in-law died in hospices, and if you've seen that, that's pretty horrible. I had colleagues at work who I went to see in a hospice, you know, dying of cancer. So please don't think I'm some sort of super person or effortlessly gliding over it. No, I'm afraid. And the answer to fear, I've found, is the presence of God, and that's what makes a huge difference to me, not in some supernatural way, but for example, when I'm being wheeled into operations, and when you're being wheeled in, the thought does cross your mind, well, what are they going to find when they open you up, and am I ever going to come round? And then I remember the words of God. For example, the 23rd Psalm, which is perhaps the most famous chapter in the Bible. Yes, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And that's what I feel, that God is with me, and he's there. And I feel I can trust him, that he's trustworthy, he's real. And that although he doesn't build a bypass around the valley of the shadow of death, because it's given to man once to die and after that the judgment, the Bible says, God is with us. And that's what's amazing. And that sense of God's presence makes all the difference to me in cancer.
Have you always felt that? Have you always been a Christian? Did you grow up in a church going home and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did, but my faith became a lot more real to me. Now, that doesn't always happen. Some people go the other way. I can only speak for myself that, two things. One, this powerful sense of the presence of God, especially when I read his word. I feel that's God speaking to me, almost a letter from God to me. And some of the things jump out of the page. For example, Jesus says, look, I'm with you always, even to the very end of the age. So if we're a Christian, God isn't going to leave us at half time and go off and do something else. No, he's with us to the end. And that's really powerful, and that really comforts me.
Yes. I was going to ask you one kind of question. Actually, on Slido, someone's asked a much better version of it. So I was going to ask you, how has Jesus shaped your experience with cancer? But this person has asked, in what ways has cancer shaped your relationship with Jesus?
A lady called Corrie ten Boom was a Dutch lady in the Second World War. She and her family hid Jewish refugees, but they were caught by the Gestapo. And she and her sister, who died, and her father went to a concentration camp. And she said this, I only realized that Christ was all I needed when Christ was all I had. So losing everything else, I had to stop. I had to go home from the hospital and say, I've got to stop work immediately. And I stopped working. Everything that had been my life came to an abrupt halt. And as I say in my best-selling book, I don't make any money. I must be becoming soft in my old age. I don't make any money from this.
But
we'd like to give you a copy afterwards, Beyond the Big Sea, which tells my story of cancer. I realized that all I needed was Christ. So it's like if you're in a building and there's lots and lots of lights, like here, spotlights here and there, and all the other lights go out, then the most powerful light becomes incredibly powerful. So that's what's happened to me. The tremendous reality of Jesus Christ.
Because someone else has asked, do you think your faith has gotten stronger through this journey? Or has it been challenged?
I think both. Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. Mm. And do I have doubts and questions? Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do, of course, wonder why me? Why not somebody else? Why not Glenn Scrivener, for example?
Yeah, sure.
Not to wish anything on anyone. No, you absolutely do think that. But again, at the same time as a challenge, then you feel a rescuer coming. You feel like you're drowning. Mm. And you feel like someone is throwing you a life belt.
Right, right.
Now, if you're not drowning, then you don't feel that. And I think becoming a Christian, one of the most important things is to realize, actually, I need treatment.
Yes.
So that people think of the Christian church like a university where you need to get excellent grades to get in and it's for very moral people. That's completely wrong. Christian faith is like a hospital.
Right.
Where you think, actually, I urgently need treatment.
Right.
And that's what God offers, treatment.
Right, right. Or I'm thinking of another famous story. Jesus said, the wise man built his house on the rock, the foolish man built his house upon the sand. When the storm hits, and it's not a question of if the storm hits, but when the storm hits, that's what reveals whether you have a foundation that can survive the storms of life. And actually, a storm has hit in a massive way. And I guess you have seen with a greater keenness what doesn't survive the storm and what does survive the storm. So if Jesus helps you survive the storm, what is it about Jesus that can help you get through this?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things for me is what I'd call a sense of God understands what I'm going through because he's gone through it himself. Mm. So the Christian claim is this. You must decide if it's true, that the eternal God that made the whole universe, made billions and billions of galaxies, made us, that the world is screwed up, which it is. Just look at the coronavirus, look at cancer, look at all sorts of things. And it's not just screwed up because of natural things. It's also screwed up because of, if we're honest, the things that each one of us have done wrong. Each one of us have broken our relationship with God. So our problem is not just the evil without, but also the evil within. Hmm. But the wonderful good news is that God didn't leave us in that mess, but he came into the mess and he became a human being. A man called Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German pastor who stood up against the Nazi persecution of the Jews. He was imprisoned, and just before the end of the Second World War, he was executed on Hitler's orders. But he managed to smuggle out of his jail cell a little piece of paper, and on it he wrote this: only a suffering God can help us. Hmm. Only a suffering God can help us. So that's the Christian claim, that God himself, the eternal God, became a human being. Jesus Christ, Christians believe, 100% human, 100% divine, and suffered. Hmm. Now, I have no choice about my suffering. I have to suffer. It's just life. But Jesus had a choice. In fact, the Bible tells us that in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was standing there and he could see the soldiers coming to arrest him. But he knew what was going to happen. He knew he was going to be crucified. He knew he was going to die, but he let that happen. Now, he didn't want that to happen because of his human nature. He said, Father, if it's your will, take this cup away from me. But let not my will, but your will be done. So what motivated Jesus to go through that appalling suffering, much worse than anything I could ever do? And the answer is because he loved us. Mm. Because there was no other way to get us right with God. So for me, the fact that God himself knows what it's like to suffer and suffered because he loves me and loves, I believe, each one of us, I find that amazing.
Yeah, he's joined you in the valley to walk with you through it. Here's a great question. Has cancer affected the way that your banking friends have related to you?
That's a good question. Hmm. I think so. I think everybody's different. Some people, but that's rather few, I think, are less interested in you when you're not the CEO. But I think most of my friends are real friends. And what I find is that they're a bit intrigued. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what's it like? And one thing I love to do is I love to offer to my friends, would you like to read the Bible with me? Would you like to have a chat with me about the Bible? And, yeah, quite a few people do. Mm-hmm. And when they do it, they find something incredible, which is hope. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's in short supply in the city and everywhere. So when you read, for example, in John's Gospel, the story of Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus. I guess my friends, I think, whether they become Christians is a different question, but they can see two characteristics of Jesus. One characteristic is his compassion, that God's moved by our condition Christians don't believe in a remote God, but a personal God. Jesus weeps at the tomb of his friend Lazarus, whom he's just let die, even though he knows he's about to raise him from the dead. And secondly, the power of God, the power of Jesus Christ to defeat death, because he says to Lazarus, come out. And Lazarus does come out. So for me, that's really interesting, and I think my friends find that intriguing. Who's Jesus? What's he about? Who does he claim to be? And what's he like? Full of compassion and full of power. And what does that result in? It results in hope. Hope, that's an amazing thing. Hope in the face of death. Because ultimately, friends, we're all going to die. Sorry. Benjamin Franklin said famously, we can avoid everything in life except death and taxes. Having worked in private banking, I can tell you that's not altogether true. Although I'm sure the good folk of Maidenhead are all fully up to date with their tax returns.
It's a bit of a haven here.
You look like a very honest bunch to me. But we can't avoid death. And that's a very basic, the most basic human need is this, well, what's the answer to death? Eddie Izzard, the transvestite comedian, said this recently. He was interviewed in The Guardian. He said, all my life I've been transfixed by the death of my mother when I was 7 from cancer, and I just wish one person had come back from beyond the grave to tell us there's something there. When I read that, my heart went out to him, because that is indeed the Christian claim. That one person not only came back from beyond the grave, but offers us a way to defeat death. So death is the end. Everybody comes to death. However, whether you're the richest man in the world or the poorest, we're all going to the same place. But there's hope. There's hope, friends, because Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. And what's not to like about, you know, what's not to like about eternal life?
Okay, but what if someone's here and they're thinking, well, of course you're going to think there's hope. Well, you know, we hope it won't rain at the weekend.
We hope Watford won't get relegated.
A vain hope indeed, what do you mean by hope? You don't just mean wishful thinking, do you?
No, it's a very legitimate question, and maybe some of you are thinking it. Because in my position, given the choice between the Richard Dawkins view that it's all meaningless and just utterly pointless and random, or hope in the face of death, why wouldn't you choose the second? So the most important question, friends, and thank you so much for coming and thank you for listening to me, is not, is the Christian faith helpful in the face of cancer? Is it helpful in the face of death? I hope what I've suggested makes that clear. You have to decide for yourself if you agree. But is it true? That's the key question, because if it's not true, it's not very useful, right? It's not hope based on nothing is just wishful thinking. So that slightly begs the question then of, you know, why do I think it's true? Christianity stands or falls on this. On the morning of Easter Sunday, 34-35 AD, whenever it was, did the events that are depicted in the four eyewitness accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, happen or not? Did Jesus come back from the dead? Did he conquer death? Did he do what Eddie Izzard was longing? Because if he didn't, then we're wasting our time here. And in fact, bankers are known for contricks. Well, this was the biggest contrick of all history, right? For 2,000 years, people have been deluded and they've been conned. Or it did happen. And that's what I believe. And why I believe it's happened is that I believe the eyewitness accounts stack up. And I'm a historian by training, and as a historian, you're trained to be skeptical about things. But when you look at the evidence, you look at, for example, why did the eyewitnesses, why did the disciples die for something they knew either wasn't true or was kind of a nice idea, which I'm afraid is what some people believe, that Jesus didn't really come back from the dead, but the idea of Jesus continued. I would use a very rude expression beginning with B and S, but that's wrong. No, that's not what Christians believe. So you have to decide for yourself if it's true. I'm not trying to impose my ideas on you. I'm please asking you, please think for yourself, have an open mind, and look at some of the evidence.
Yes, yeah. And we'll have a think about that in a second as I speak from John's Gospel about some of that evidence. We've had a great question from Ollie, age 10, watching from home.
Hi, Ollie.
When have you known God with you?
That's a great question. Thank you, Ollie. I would say, first of all, feelings come and go, and cancer is a roller coaster. And sometimes you feel the presence of God very strongly, mm-hmm. and sometimes you don't feel it so much. So I don't put my reliance on my feelings, which come and go, but I put it on God's promises, which I find, for the reasons I've just said, reliable and trustworthy. But to answer the question, Ollie, I feel that the most when I'm at my lowest ebb. Mm-hmm. So I feel that the most when I'm being wheeled in for an operation. Mm. And then it's almost tangible. It's not, because that would be a vision, right? But Jesus says, and I know you're going to talk about this, Glenn, that blessed are those who haven't seen, who weren't eyewitnesses, and have yet believed. Mm. That's the Christian claim, that we can rely on the things the eyewitness tell us, and because and through that word, through that trustworthy communication, mm. we can know God. And that when we look at the evidence, and that's what I find, when I look at the eyewitness accounts, that Jesus, as it were, steps off the page. It's almost like a hand coming off the page and sort of prodding me in the chest. Mm. And that's what I need. I need a friend. I need a rescuer. Mm. I can't do this. I can't do cancer on my own. It's too hard, and it's going to kill me eventually. I need someone to rescue me.
Yeah, yeah. Last two questions. So you're living on borrowed time, as are we all. It's just a bit more heightened for you. What is the rest of your life all about?
Oh, I've no idea, Glenn. I don't know. I don't know because life's so short. Mm. But this I love doing. If I only had a week left, I'd do this. Mm. And then my wife might have other thoughts. You know? Shall I say, no, you're not doing this. I just love telling people about the Lord.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel I would be like, imagine when you do chemo, you sit in these nice chairs like this and you're kind of wired up to a mini chemical works and you can't move. And you're in a big ward or room with lots of other people doing it. Imagine if I was there and I had a cure for cancer. I had the answer and I was taking it and I didn't tell the other people in the room. And they found out, what would they feel like? They'd be mad, mad as hell. But if you're a Christian and we're not telling our friends that we've got hope in the face of death, that's exactly what we're doing. So I feel this urgent imperative to share. Not in that there's anything better about me. No, there's not. I'm not a good person. I'm a bad person. I'm not fearlessly going through life, I'm afraid. So it's not about me, it's about Jesus Christ. And I want to tell everybody about him, and I love doing it. Mm. It's great fun. Mm. I love doing it. Mm-hmm. It's much more fun than being the CEO of a bank. But sadly, not so well paid.
And one of the ways you've been telling lots of people about Jesus is writing this book. My final question is, I'll begin you on your final answer because you're probably too modest to give this as an answer. But in terms of what advice you would give to those who want to investigate Christian faith, that's my final question. And I'll get you going by saying this would be a great follow-up for anyone investigating Christian faith. Beyond the Big C, Hope in the Face of Death by Jeremy Marshall. And this has been selling like hotcakes out there.
Flying off the shelves.
And you can get your very own copy at the back tonight. We'd love you to pick this up and keep reading and investigate Christianity further that way. What other ways can people...
First of all, I think the question of is there an answer to death is the most important question. Mm. There is no question more important for humanity because each of us is going to have to die. All sorts of other things may or may not happen, but there's a 100% death rate in this room, sorry. So this is the most important question, but yet it's the one question we don't want to think about. That's the human paradox. Two, God promises this. If you seek me with all your heart, you will surely find me. Mm. God is actually reaching out to each one of us. He wants nobody to perish, the Bible says. God is patient, not wanting any to perish, but everyone to come to eternal life. Mm. You have to decide for yourself if the question has an answer or not. How do you do that? By looking at the evidence, by kicking the tires. If you go and buy a car, which is a very small thing, you test drive it, you look at reports, you analyze it, you kick the tires, you open the bonnet, you look at the car. Please do the same. We're not asking you to take a leap of faith. We're asking you to have an open mind and look at the evidence. And how can you do that? Three ways, I guess. One is there's excellent courses that are run here starting next Monday called Christianity Explored. If a group thing's your thing, this is just discussing. We're not browbeating you. We're not bashing you. It's just a group of people sitting around together trying to find the truth. If you say, I don't like groups, I don't want to talk about what I think with a lot of strangers, then do one-to-one. Mm. The Christian who maybe invited you here, or if you haven't got one, just email the church. Sit down with them over a coffee, give them half an hour, have a look at the eyewitness accounts, decide if it's true. If it is true, it's the most important thing. Mm. And thirdly, you could even go, and you can do all three, come along to St. Mary's. It's a friendly church. Mm-hmm. We're not a bunch of hyper-moral people. We're sick people who have found a cure. Mm. And we want to tell other people about it.
Mm. Fantastic. That's very good advice. And ladies and gentlemen, should we give Jeremy Marshall a big round of applause? Thank you so much.